The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Elantris was beautiful once. It was called the City of the Gods, a place of power, radiance, and magic. As magnificent as Elantris was, its inhabitants were more so. Their hair, a brilliant white, their skin, an almost metallic silver. The Elantrians seemed to shine like the very city itself. They were divinities. Elantris, the home of the gods, where one could live in bliss, rule in wisdom, and be worshipped for an eternity. Eternity ended 10 years ago.
Go to the heathen peoples of the West. Declare to them my final warning.
I care nothing for the squabbles between the two sects, priest. Go convert someone who doesn't believe.
You should not dismiss the offering of worms so casually.
Honestly, priest, do we need to go through this? Your threats hold no weight. Fjordan hasn't held any real influence for 2 centuries.
Fjordan is more powerful now than it ever was before. The day of empire is at hand, and my glory will soon shine forth.
Cannot be! Prince Raoden is stricken with the Sheo!
The pagan nations of Aerilon and Teod have been blackened scars upon my land for long enough.
Elantris.
That Fjordel Gjorn is interested in Elantris for some reason. And I make it my business never to ignore what a Gjorn finds interesting.
You seem to be rather preoccupied with a single priest, Eni.
Not a priest, Uncle. A full Gjorn.
Still only one man. How much damage can he do?
Ask the Duladan Republic. I think this is the same Gjorn who was involved in that disaster.
The holy soldiers of Fjordan will descend on the nation like hunting predators, rending and tearing the unworthy life from those who heed not my words. Convert or fall forever. There are no other choices.
Every pain, Sue, every cut, every nick, every bruise, and every ache, they will stay with you until you go mad from the suffering. Welcome to Elantris.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Bunny, I'm so sorry.
You don't know what they did to her, my daughter.
We need everyone's best to get her out. Lieutenant Sweezer's best is very good, and it could save Brun's life.
They're talking as if she were just a game piece. Unless she's dead, she's planning on doing something. And if we don't know what, we're going to find our plans crossing hers.
What are we doing?
End of the line, girlies. I get more from them for turning you in than from you for taking you on.
Brun?
All right, then. Let's do it.
Oh!
Can you pilot?
Release. Start up. Drive on.
She's heading back. Is she gonna try to land on the planet?
No. She's heading for the orbital stuff. And I think we should go get her.
You would volunteer for such a mission?
Yes, sir.
Lieutenant, the artificial gravity's on.
It shouldn't be. The station's a derelict.
Team Blue.
Lieutenant Sweezer here.
2 shuttles approaching with unshielded transmissions. They're planning to go in and kill everyone they find. He's coming in with way too much relative V. Gonna knock this station sideways. Counting down. 3, 2...
Serrano Legacy. Book 5. Rules of Engagement. Part 2.
from Graphic Audio.
And now, for our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's The Last Gunfighter. Narrated by Ken Jackson. With performances by James Konacek, David Coyne, Kate Foster, Casey Platt, Christopher Graybill, Jonathan Watkins, Andy Clements, Jeff Baker, Michael Glenn, Mort Shelby, Dylan Lynch, Jason Stiles, Tim Getman, Joe Brack, Colleen Delaney, Elliot Dash, Terrence Aselford, Richard Rowan, and Nanette Savard. The Last Gunfighter, number 10, Manhunt.
Dying ought to be something a man does in private.
Frank Morgan sat with his back propped up against three feather pillows. Most of the stuffing had long since worked its way out of the canvas ticking, and it was bunched up behind him in a grimy wad. Morgan stared, blank-faced, through the dusty window at the bleak world outside. A frigid wind had blown for weeks across the flat West Texas plain, with no more than a fence post and a few strands of wire to stop it. The wind rattled the rippled glass window pane and sent a strong enough draft through the dingy hotel room to flicker the flame on the single beeswax candle at the bedside table. The gunfighter watched as another tumbleweed piled its brittle gray skeleton against a dozen others along a fence row outside. He shook his head and let it fall to one side so he could look the young Texas Ranger in the eye.
I'd be much obliged to you, Beaumont, if you just clear out of here. Let me be alone when the time comes.
I heard yesterday that a pretty whore named Rita lived up here in this very room a few years back. They say she got so plumb sick and tired of trying to look out these stinking little windows that she rented her a room over at the Claremont instead. Poor thing died of consumption last year, but at least she had a decent view toward the end. I reckon a whore spends enough time cooped up in her room, she deserves a decent piece of glass.
I reckon I think I'll take a nap for a while. If it wouldn't disturb you too awful much.
Beaumont held a piece of heavy yellow paper rolled up in a tube in his hand.
Don't you even want to take a peek at what I brought?
Morgan had to give the boy credit. He'd stuck by him for weeks, trying to cheer him up, trying to nursemaid him through the depths of despair that followed the confrontation with the killer, Ephraim Swan. Frank could tell the poor ranger was worried to the point of vexation, but he couldn't bring himself to care. Beaumont read him the paper every day, but there was no news worth hearing. He tried to engage Morgan in card games, but even when Frank held a winning hand, he folded anyway. The exasperated ranger even hired a girl to come in and sing. Sing she did, everything from beautiful arias to bawdy barroom ballads, but she'd reminded Morgan of Dixie's Daughters. Now the boy had some other notion of a surprise rolled up in his hand. Some little something or another he thought would salve Morgan's tormented soul and somehow make him forget about the brutal murder of his innocent wife. Something that would set everything right in the world again. Since Dixie's death, Frank Morgan had felt little more than an empty husk of a man. If he walked outside, he knew he'd blow away like one of the passing tumbleweeds on the cold West Texas wind. In the weeks since the standoff with Swan, Morgan had been slow to recover physically. He hardly ate more than a nibble and spent all his waking hours gazing out the tiny window in his rented room. The doctor insisted there was no reason why he shouldn't make a full recovery and regain his complete health. But though his body continued to mend, Frank knew the part of him that was really alive was slipping away with each passing day. His long, dark hair had more silver to it than ever, and it stuck out in all directions, depending on how he slept. He kept his pistol handy on a peg beside the bed and threatened to shoot anyone who came near him with a comb. A heavy, matted tangle of salt and pepper beard couldn't hide the hollows of his cheeks or the sunken crescents under his eyes. Frank Morgan looked and smelled of death. The man who couldn't be beaten had simply given up.
Velda was the only one with brains around here. She left when the getting was good. I wouldn't want to sit around and watch a used-up old gunfighter right away any more than she did.
Her leaving had nothing to do with you, Frank. Velda just never could get used to settling down to a respectable life. Last I heard, she'd run off with a sassy gambler from Waco who had more money than he had good sense. Now you quit with all this talk about rotten. Doc says you're getting better in spite of your grumpy nature. A man like you is too tough to be done in by a little blood leakage.
Son, the things you don't know about a man like me could fill a mighty big book.
I know plenty, you old cob. I grew up on Frank Morgan stories. My pa used to tell me about your escapades when I was just a sprout. My only aim was to grow up to be just like Frank Morgan. I grew up idolizing you, and if you'd get off your hind end, I still would.
I don't care much to be emulated. It's too damn burdensome a responsibility.
Now listen here, Morgan. The bubbles downstairs in Mrs. Pratt's weather-guessing glass say we can expect some clearing tomorrow, and some warmer weather, I'd expect.
Tyler spread the paper flat out in front of him so Frank could read it.
I got something here that might be just the cure for what ails you.
Morgan scanned the yellow flyer. A big drawing of two crossed Colt peacemakers decorated the top third of the paper. It was tattered at the corners from hanging on a post in the screaming wind. He gave it a quick look and shook his head.
I don't care to enter any shooting contest. I've been enough of those for 10 lifetimes.
Don't have to enter it. Just come and watch me. Cheer me along while I shoot. It'd do you good to get out. What do you say?
Morgan took up the paper and read it over more thoroughly at arm's length.
Potter County Spring Shooting Championship. Says here they have cash prizes. You think you might earn yourself a little grub stake and win Miss Velda back from that fool gambler?
Now why don't you just forget about her? She's gone. Come on, Morgan, what do you say?
Frank folded the small poster in half lengthwise and handed it back.
Why are you still here?
I don't know myself, Morgan, the way you're acting. There's at least three men in Amarillo who'd shoot you there in your bedclothes just to say they were the one who killed the great Frank Morgan. None of them give a tinker's damn whether you're asleep in your bed or facing them on the street. I figured after what you did for me, I owed you a little watching over. You and my pa were friends. Good friends from what he used to tell me. I gotta tell you, though, I'm tuckered out, Frank. And I've got a long ton of other things I could be doing. If you really want me gone, that's what I'll do.
Frank could see the young man had about given up. He knew he stood to watch the only friend he had for miles walk out the door. But the fact that he decided to get up and make a go of it had little to do with him being left alone. Morgan knew about loneliness, and most times he relished it. It was something the boy had said that made Morgan pull himself up. It reached out and shook him is what it did.
I suppose I could come and watch you show up a bunch of upstarts with your marksmanship. But son, you'd better adjust your windage and elevation. Aiming to be anything like me is what I'd call a misspent endeavor.
When Morgan scraped away his grizzled beard and trimmed back his wayward hair, he looked like he'd lost a tenth of his body weight. He was skinny as a picket rail. His faded blue shirt hung off his body like rags on a scarecrow. He pulled a heavy wool coat tight at the collar to keep the harsh panhandle wind from going right through him. Morgan's peacemaker hung on a peg above the headboard of his bed. Morgan pulled the wide leather gun belt around his waist and realized he'd need to punch another hole to keep it from ending up around his ankles.
We've got time to stop and get us some decent grub before the shooting starts. Make sure you strap that gun on tight. There's a fierce wind blowing out there, and that pistol's liable to be the only thing anchoring you to the ground.
Morgan took his black felt hat off the wall peg and settled it down on his head. It felt good to have it on again. Beyond that, it was the only piece of his former attire that still fit. The short Texas Ranger hovered constantly all the way to the cafe, wary of the half-dozen gunmen he said were waiting in the wings to challenge the infamous Frank Morgan. Beaumont made it clear with every word and gesture that even talking out loud about a challenge could earn a man a bullet. Morgan took a seat near the back, facing the door. The waitress gave him an obligated grin and tapped her pencil on a piece of folded paper. She was pretty, but closer to Beaumont's age than Frank's. They ordered beefsteak and a pot of strong coffee. It wasn't long in coming.
You're making me feel like a damn kid, looking after me this way. I've been taking care of myself long enough to get a handle on how it's done, I reckon.
Now look, Frank, you still got a ways to go before you're up to snuff again. I know of at least six desperados who are waiting for the opportunity to call you out. I don't count the dozen I ain't ever even heard of. You should sit back and take it easy.
I might surprise you, youngster. I've been on my own for a good many years now, more than I care to count.
I ain't saying you can't. I'm just saying you ought to be careful. You should...
Look, son, I appreciate everything you're doing for me. You stuck by me, and I know I'm acting the ass. You keep reminding me that I got so much to live for. But let me give you a little piece of advice. No matter how much you think you got to live for, don't try to hold on to it too tight. You're liable to wear yourself out just hanging on. Sometimes you just gotta relax. Take what comes at you. Now, who are these men who'd like to face me while I'm on the mend?
Same story, different names. See that brooding kid over there by the bar with the withered right hand all drawed up like an eagle's claw? He goes by the moniker of Lefty Cummins. Blames the whole world for his defect. He's been out of prison a grand total of 3 weeks for killing a poor sod buster who looked at his crippled hand wrong. Did 5 years for manslaughter, and the first thing he does as a free man is slide into Amarillo looking to brace you.
Too bad. I reckon he'll dog along after me a little while yet.
Frank threw some coins on the table and started for the door, and Lefty Cummins.
Be seeing you around, I reckon.
Morgan smiled as he came up beside the would-be gunfighter. He paused at the bar a moment. Morgan held another gold coin up between his thumb and forefinger so the bartender could see it, then placed it down on the scratched wooden counter with a snap.
I'm buying him one more, whatever he's having.
Morgan moved slowly toward the door, listening and waiting for the kid's next move. Cummins turned and stared over his shoulder, but kept his gun hand wrapped around his glass, both elbows on the bar. He said nothing. This one still had a while to go yet before he was ripe enough to fall off the tree and get himself stomped.
Oh, I wish I never would have shown you that damn handbill.
That's just the old nerves talking, son. I think you're gonna enjoy this.
Oh, I'm not worried about the competition. That's gonna be fine. It's all the folks flitting around there so well-armed that's got me thinking.
Beaumont eyed two skinny boys in their early teens as they rushed past in the gangly knees and elbows way boys that age were prone to move. One carried a forked pea shooter with India rubber flippers. The other had a rusty Colt Dragoon as long as his thigh bone strapped to his side in an old Confederate holster with the flap cut off.
Oh, hell, Frank, even the kiddies are running around with horse pistols. Everybody and his brother wants to prove himself against Frank Morgan, and here we are aiming to saunter in amongst them while they're hopped up on prickly ash bitters and gunpowder fumes. Now that I finally have you convinced to try and live, I'm thinking this may not have been the smartest notion that ever hit me in the head.
Look how well these streets are laid out. Straight as a damn Comanche arrow.
Yeah, the country's so flat there was nothing to get in the way while they were building the place, except maybe a longhorn cow.
It was impossible to escape the salt-sour smell of cattle on the wind. The rangy beasts were everywhere, mooing and crowding and standing on mountains of their own crap. Frank had heard someone observe that the population of Amarillo was somewhere around 500 human souls, half that many dogs, and 15,000 head of cattle. The Potter County Spring Fair and Shooting Exposition was set up at the local grounds at the far edge of town, adjacent to one of the many feedlots and holding pens. It reminded Morgan of a Wild West show he'd seen once in Missouri, complete with sad-faced Apache Indians wearing Cheyenne war bonnets and nimble young women doing cartwheels on horseback wearing puffy-legged bloomers. Cigar and gun smoke mixed with the odor of burnt sugar, cooking meat, and the nearby feedlots. Some of the older folks wore buckskins and other costumes from their past, dressing as they had when they were young and trying to remind themselves that although Amarillo was relatively tame, the wild and woolly West was still only a few steps away. White canvas tents billowed and popped against the wind. Beaumont was right. Everyone there was packing iron, and a good many of them threw Frank a challenging eye as he brushed by them in the crowd.
I haven't seen this many folks in one place since the last hanging I happened onto in New Mexico. Nasty old bandit drew a hell of a crowd. Everyone for miles came to see him dance at the gallows.
Beaumont had stopped listening and stood with a small group of men in front of a flapping canvas windbreak. His eyes locked fast on something out of Morgan's view, and his mouth hung open wide enough to show his back teeth. Morgan drew up next to him to find out what had captured the young ranger's attention so.
That just might be the most handsome pistol I ever set my eyes on.
Beaumont nodded toward a nickel-plated Colt Bisley with black buffalo horn grips and feathered engraving along the barrel and side plates.
You like it, Ranger?
The jowly man behind the display table hooked a thumb behind the strap of his overalls and gave a condescending nod toward the handgun.
Go ahead, try it on for size.
Beaumont picked up the Colt and measured its heft and balance. He cocked it, sighted down the barrel, and let the hammer down with a slow, almost reverent click.
Whew. What do you think, Frank? It would take me 2 months on ranger pay just to afford the grips.
That's a fine-looking piece, that's for certain. Have to wonder how it shoots, though. I seem to remember the good book talking about painted and prettied up graves still having dead man's bones inside them.
Shoots like a dream, if the man behind it has the grit and know-how how to use it.
How many chests of gold doubloons would a gun like this here cost?
Beaumont looked starry-eyed and love-struck as he gazed into the bright finish on the revolver.
Don't cost a penny, on account of it ain't for sale. You gotta win it. It's the grand prize in the pistol match this afternoon.
Now, I'm a pretty fair marksman. The $2 entry fee would be money well spent if I happen to win.
What kind of contest is this supposed to be?
Well, I'm not certain. That surly old cob was awful tight-lipped about the whole thing. Just said it would be a true test of your shooting proficiency. I reckon we'll know soon enough. It starts in about an hour, right after the long gun stuff.
I say, let's get a cup of coffee then, before the real shooting starts. I'd like to find me a chair and rest my bones for a minute or two before I watch you win yourself a fancy new pistol.
20 minutes and 2 cups of coffee later, Morgan felt invigorated and rested. He leaned back in the little folding wooden chair, felt the sun against his face, when a hefty boy who looked like a dipper gourd with freckles came running up with a tan envelope wadded in his dimpled fist. The boy was all of 10 years old.
Mr. Morgan.
Tommy Parrish. How are things down at the telegraph office?
Busy.
What can we do for you, Tommy? Ranger Beaumont here says everyone in these parts wants to challenge me to a gunfight. You haven't come to call me out now, have you?
Oh, no, sir. I never...
Nah, I'm joshing with you, Tommy. Have a seat. I'll buy you a sweet cake.
No, thank you, Mr. Morgan. I gotta be getting on back.
Well, suit yourself, then. I can see you're a busy man.
Tommy grinned and turned to go until Beaumont touched him on the arm.
Aren't you forgetting something?
The boy looked at him blank-faced for a moment, then held out the envelope.
Oh, I'm awful sorry. My ma says I'm a knothead most of the time, and I reckon she's right on that account.
You're no knothead, son.
Frank fished 2 bits out of his pocket and handed it over to the boy.
Now you go on, buy yourself a piece of sweet cake or some other such candy treat, and enjoy it out of the sight of us needling adults.
You got yourself a missive?
That I do. Oh, that I do.
Are you going to tell me who it's from?
You wouldn't know him.
Mercy Monfour tied her buggy to the iron ring on one of the upright wooden posts in front of Witherspoon's Hardware and Mercantile. She was a creature of habit, and Tuesday had been laundry day for as long as she could remember. She had a strong notion that her mother, and likely her grandmother before her, had done laundry on Tuesday mornings as well. Her husband, the judge, was particular about his shirts and insisted that they be sparkling white. When Mercy found she was out of Mrs. Stewart's bluing, she had decided to put off the chore until later that afternoon. Her plan was to pick up the bluing before meeting her husband for lunch. Witherspoon's store was situated on the wide town square directly across from Parker County's beautiful limestone courthouse. She would be able to run her quick errand and then leave her buggy parked where it was while she took the covered basket of fried chicken and biscuits across to her husband's chambers. Isaiah had a healthy appetite and loved it when she brought him a home-cooked meal for lunch. He often said no one could cook chicken as good as she did. She loved to make him happy. Mercy liked the spring, when there was plenty of open space around the square. In the late summer, when melons and peaches were in full harvest, it would be difficult to find a place to tie up a pony, much less a four-wheeled buggy. As a child, she had loved climbing in and out of all the wagons on trade day, sliding with her little friends over slick, ripe melons, and dodging the teams with her friends as if they were invincible. Now, the pressing crowds of people and animals made her nervous. When summer was at its peak and the square was packed wheel to wheel with row after row of wagons, Mercy consigned herself to her house away from all the hubbub. Then, and only then, she let the judge fend for himself for lunch and eat other people's fried chicken. Mercy pulled the slipknot snug on the tie rope and gave her Cleveland Bay mare a pat on the forehead. The day was turning out to be warm for early spring, and the little brown mare swished her tail back and forth to chase off a green-backed fly. Mercy smoothed the front of her yellow dress and turned to fetch her shopping bag from the buggy. She wasn't very tall and had to stand on tiptoe to reach the bag on the far seat.
You'd best get out of the way, Mercy.
Oh!
She gave a little start and spun around, unwilling to be caught in such an unladylike position. Nelson Ross, a prominent lawyer in town and a good friend of her husband, came out of the hardware store wearing a brown bowler hat and a grim look. The lawyer wore a gun belt. The tail of his pinstriped suit coat was pulled back to expose his sidearm. He had a pale, sandy complexion that looked out of place in the outdoors, as if the bright sun might do him harm.
Mr. Ross, is there something the matter?
Mercy pulled the canvas shopping bag up in front of her chest and retreated a step back toward her buggy.
What's happening here?
Even as she asked, she knew the answer. With county elections coming up, tempers ran high. Petty disagreements and feuds that had merely simmered for years suddenly boiled over on a daily basis. The whole town seemed turned upside down. Before he could answer, the door creaked open again, and Sheriff Rance Whitehead stepped out into the bright daylight.
Please step back, Mrs. Monfort. The judge would have my hide if you got hurt in this matter.
The tall lawman sounded sincere, but Mercy knew he made a living sounding like something he was not. The mere fact that he'd acted like he cared what the judge thought was a joke. Her husband never mentioned the sheriff's name without a spit and stream of vehement swearing. She was certain the lawman harbored the same feelings for her husband. Whitehead was tall, with black hair slicked back under a dark felt hat. Everything about him, including his toothy white smile as his lips pulled back behind a thick mustache, seemed oily and fake. If he wasn't the sheriff, he would likely have sold snake oil. The judge often said the man's present job suited him better because it allowed him to lie and murder with relative impunity. The sheriff was square-jawed and handsome. Had it not been for the overall air of guile that surrounded the man, he would have not been unpleasant to look at. The two men walked onto the deserted courthouse square and faced each other. They circled slowly, not 10 yards apart. Mercy could do nothing but stand by helplessly and watch.
Since when did you start packing a sidearm, Ross? You know those damn things will only get you into trouble and grief. You got something on your mind that requires you to sport a pistol?
You know the answer to that. A man's got a right to protect himself.
Ross's hand hovered uneasily above the butt of his gun. The sallow lawyer was no gunfighter, but he did have a temper and a stubborn streak that wouldn't let him back away from a rabid dog.
You seem all fired ready to get yourself killed today.
The sheriff advanced, pressing the other man. He talked like he wanted to avert the fight, but Mercy could see the hint of a smile in his eyes. He wanted Ross to draw.
Why don't we just go over to my office and talk about this?
Even as he spoke of a truce, his sure fingers tapped the grip on his own pistol. He looked bored. Ross gave an irate shake of his head.
The things you're doing, Whitehead. Everyone in the county knows what you and your boys are up to. We can all... You stay where you are, Sheriff. Any fool can see what's happening here.
Is that a fact?
Damn right, it's a fact. There are those of us who refuse to allow this to happen.
Allow? Allow what to happen? You've had your melon out in the sun too long. You're talking out of your head, Ross.
Sheriff Whitehead stepped forward, closing the distance between himself and his trembling opponent. He pressed, but his voice remained calm.
Easy there with that gun hand, mister.
Ross raised his left hand as if to ward off the advancing lawman.
All right, now you see here, Whitehead.
Mercy's breath caught in her throat as the fingers of Ross's right hand brushed across the wooden grips of his revolver.
Oh!
The sheriff's pistol appeared to leap from his holster and spit fire and smoke. The wide-eyed lawyer now stood less than 5 feet away. He staggered forward, clutching at Whitehead's shoulder, clawing pitifully for a handhold to keep himself on his feet. The lawman shrugged him off. Ross shuddered once, the color draining from his already pale face as a red stain bloomed across his chest. He opened his mouth to speak, but nothing came out. His gun had never cleared leather. Mercy was certain he'd never even intended to draw. She clutched the canvas bag in front of her until her fingers turned white. Whitehead turned slowly to her and shook his head. His face creased in the kind of false sympathy you might show a child when a pet grasshopper died. He reholstered and tipped his hat.
I'm sorry you had to be a witness to such a tragedy, Mrs. Monfort, but you saw it. The fool left me no choice.
Mercy stood motionless, hardly daring to breathe. The lump in her throat bound her voice, and she could not speak. The speed with which Whitehead had gunned down poor Nelson Ross was nothing short of phenomenal. Though it was well settled, Parker County was only just on the verge of becoming truly civilized, and Mercy had been witness to more than her share of bloody gunfights. In all those fights, she'd only seen one man as fast as Rance Whitehead with a gun. But that was so many years ago, when that man was young, and she loved him more than she ever thought she could love anyone. She prayed that man would arrive soon. Beaumont looked a little on the fidgety side for the tough-minded Texas Ranger Morgan knew him to be. He kept rubbing his chin as if to smooth the beard he couldn't quite grow. The broad little ranger paid his $2 and signed the entry book. He looked back at Morgan.
Why don't you enter, Frank? I wouldn't mind so much losing to you.
Don't worry, you'll be losing to me anyhow. It won't matter who else enters.
The kid wore a flashy blue bib front shirt and a mousy large-brimmed Stetson with a slight dip in the front. He was barely edging up to his mid-20s, if that. His blonde hair hung in loose curls and reached his shoulders in the shade of the wide hat. A few wisps of golden beard and mustache adorned his chin and upper lip. He was every inch the dandy. Morgan thrust out a hand.
Why, Mr. Custer, always did want to meet you. Must have my history all wrong. Thought you were killed on Little Bighorn.
He eyed the kid with an interested smile. Sometimes, dandies were the best shots off the line. They cared enough about their image to put in countless hours of practice. In his experience, though, most didn't hold up under pressure. The dandy returned the smile and shook the offered hand. He had a strong enough grip to be a competent gunman.
Very funny. I suppose if I wasn't asking for it, I might take offense. The name's Ferguson. Chaz Ferguson.
As in the Ferguson rifle?
Only a distant relative.
Distant or not, it was a hell of a revolutionary long gun. You got genius in your blood. Pleasure to meet you, Mr. Ferguson. Frank Morgan.
The Frank Morgan?
I don't know about the, but I'm definitely a Frank Morgan.
Forgive me, sir, but I heard you passed away.
Not by a long shot, he hasn't. Tyler Beaumont, Texas Rangers. Are you planning to enter?
I've already paid my fee. I'd be glad to pay your fee as well, Mr. Morgan, if you'd care to try your skill against me.
He tossed a gold piece in the air. Frank's hand snaked out and snatched the spinning coin. He placed it back in Ferguson's open palm.
Mighty kind of you, but I can pay my own way, thank you.
Frank fished the entry fee out of his pocket and signed the book. He looked at Beaumont and grinned.
I'm feeling better. Maybe if I don't shoot my foot off, you'll relax and stop lording over me like a mother hen.
A half an hour later, Morgan stood in a line of other shooters, listening to a heavyset man from the Cattlemen's Association explain the rules of the contest.
All right, gentlemen, listen here now.
He held out both hands to shush the crowd.
My name is Harry Lofton. I'll be the line judge, and my rulings will be final. Any problems you have with my decisions, you may take up with my associates.
The self-important man in the bib overalls waved with thick fingers toward two men carrying double-barreled coach guns who stood at either end of the firing line on raised platforms. A row of 28 contestants towed the white chalk line. Four others had backed out of the competition without a refund when they saw Morgan was a contestant, but stayed in the crowd to watch him shoot.
On my mark, you will all fire one elimination round of six shots at the targets before you.
Lofton jerked a stubby thumb over his shoulder toward a row of ringed paper targets some 20 paces away.
The best 10 of you will move on to the next round of competition. Take as long as you like, up to 1 minute. Is everyone ready?
We will be if you get your fat ass out of the way.
The line judge gave the man who spoke a pinched smile and stepped out of the way, drawing his own pistol from an absurd-looking Buscadero rig cinched around the bulging girth of his bib overalls. Frank had taken up a position with Beaumont to his immediate right and Ferguson to his left. A grizzle-faced cowboy in a dusty black hat stood in between him and the blonde dandy. The targets weren't that far away, considering the distances he'd shot before, but Morgan wasn't accustomed to having so much time on his hands. In a sure-enough all-out gun battle, a minute was generally enough time to do his business, go get the Undertaker, and maybe even roll a smoke. When the line judge fired his gun to start the countdown, Frank held his peace and watched. Beaumont was quick out of the holster and concentrating so hard on the target, he didn't appear to notice Frank wasn't shooting. Others in the line took differing lengths of time, some using two hands and squinting down the barrels and leaning way back like they were scared the guns might explode in their hands. The smart-mouthed rounder with the cud full of chewing tobacco had his tongue out to one side while he fired. When he looked to his left, Frank realized Ferguson was standing with his hands folded at his belt, watching him. The dandy looked at Frank warily. There was a challenge in the narrow, pale eyes. Both would wait until the last possible moment to take their shots. Only then would the contest really begin. Guns fired intermittently as the seconds ticked by and men finished up their last few rounds. A cloud of gray and white smoke drifted down the line on the breeze. Frank knew the minute was drawing tight. He'd been subconsciously counting it down from the first pistol shot by the steady throb of pulse in his head. Beaumont finished and looked over at him as he let out half a deep breath.
Damn, Morgan! I never even heard you shoot!
I haven't yet.
Morgan slipped his peacemaker from the holster by his side in a fluid motion. He was faintly aware of the pot shots still going on around him as the rest of the line finished up. The whiskered-jowled cowboy next to him squinted downrange as he fired his last. Morgan's Colt barked six times in rapid succession, each round following closely on the heels of the one before it. The hammer snapped on the last round, and he slid the gun easily into his holster just as the line judge yelled,
"Time!"
You nearly gave me heart failure, waiting like that.
Beaumont's face was all smiles as he spoke. All six of the Rangers' rounds were well within the center ring. He'd shot nearly as well as Frank. Good enough to make the first cut, along with Ferguson, the tobacco-chewing cowboy who'd stuck his tongue out while he shot, and a ragtag group of others vying for the nickel-plated Colt. Beaumont took out his pistol and began to reload it as he spoke.
Keep showing off like that and I might just beat you, Morgan. You are just getting over a lengthy illness.
That's fine. I'm just in on this escapade for the entertainment value.
All right, boys.
The line judge nodded at the surviving 10 shooters on the line.
That was the easy part. From here on out, it gets a mite trickier.
Ferguson tipped back his fancy Stetson and peered around the tongue-chewer at Morgan.
I certainly hope so.
The next round of fire had each contestant shooting at a swinging gourd suspended from a wooden cross-timber 20 yards away. The four men with the least amount of squash still on the tether after six rounds were declared the winner. Morgan, Beaumont, Ferguson, and a raw-boned farm boy named Hackenmuller moved to the next round. In the next event, each contestant shot six rounds at fist-sized clay balls on top of wooden posts stuck in the ground, starting some 25 paces away at staggered distances. Mr. Lofton, the line judge, put his hand on his own pistol while he explained the rules.
Okay, men. Only shooters who hit every clay target move on to the next round. If no one succeeds, no one gets the prize.
That bit of news drew a rumble of angry murmurs from the crowd. It explained the reason for the assistance with shotguns.
Damn it!
Beaumont missed his last target by a hair, bringing his total to five. Hackenmuller got four. Morgan and Ferguson advanced. The young ranger took off his hat and hung his head.
I don't know why I thought I could shoot well enough to win anything.
Shooting for sport and shooting for survival are as different as thunder and lightning. They might be related, but they're a completely different animal. I'd want you next to me when bandits were about, that's for certain.
Well, bless my ever-loving soul, if it isn't Frank Morgan.
The gravel voice from the crowd behind Frank belonged to Bog Swenson, a ruddy-faced Swede with a bulbous nose that always looked like it had been stung by a swarm of two dozen angry wasps. Swenson was particular about his nose. He was known to get violent when anyone stared at the prominent feature. The problem was, he covered so much of the real estate that made up his face, it was impossible to talk to the man without spending at least a moment wondering what made his nose so red and swollen. Morgan had given the muscular Swede a sound thrashing 3 years before in a saloon near Lincoln, Nebraska. At the time, a good whipping seemed preferable to killing the loudmouthed bully. Now, Frank wondered if he might have made a bad choice in not finishing the job.
Fancy meeting up with you all the way down here in Texas. I've been looking for you a long time. Yes, sir, I have at that. I don't aim to let you get away so easy this time. No man whips me and gets away with it.
The pistol competition had drawn a large crowd. People were bunched tightly together to get a good look at the contest, and now they were having a difficult time getting out of the way. Many such fairs staged mock events like this for the entertainment of the public, and it was likely many in attendance thought this was just such a stunt.
Bog.
Morgan squared off with a slight nod of his head. His peacemaker was empty from the last round of contest fire. He was sure his challenger knew it. Likely he'd waited for the moment so he could exploit the weakness. Beaumont hadn't had time to reload either.
You're looking as well as can be expected.
I ought to give you the thumping of your sorry life, but I hear you've been sick, and it wouldn't be much fun breaking your brittle old bones. No, I reckon we'll handle it this way.
The Swede's hand hovered above the wooden grip of his pistol.
Hold on there, Bog. We got too many innocent folks around here that might get hurt if we go at it. Let's let them step aside.
The onlookers managed to get crowded together enough to form a narrow alleyway between the two gunmen, eager to watch what they thought was play-acting.
Draw, boys!
Quit talking and earn your money! Give us a damn good show!
A pimple-faced boy in his teens, wearing an old cap-and-ball Walker Colt, stood, hemmed in by the press of people, at Frank's left elbow. He was close enough to tell the men were serious.
Don't move, and you won't get hurt.
What?
Stay where you are. If you move, he's liable to shoot at you instead of me.
Bog Swenson would not normally have been much of a threat. In an honest gunfight, he'd be lucky to get the hammer thumped back. But this time, Morgan knew he was in a bit of a predicament. He could easily outdraw the big-nosed outlaw, but that didn't do him much good with an empty gun. Frank grinned at the quaking boy beside him to set him at ease, but kept a watchful eye on Swenson. The ugly Swede was moments away from jerking his pistol.
That hog leg loaded?
Adios, Morgan. You've no account. don't, son of a bitch.
Sure, it's low.
Good. Bog Swenson's shoulder dropped, and his hand reached for the gun at his hip. Morgan used his left hand to snatch the heavy dragoon from the quaking boy's holster beside him. Bog's eyes got bigger than his swollen nose when he saw what Morgan had done. A deafening boom drove the crowd back as Morgan pulled the trigger. Bog Swenson looked down at the gun he'd never had the chance to fire, then at the growing stain of blood low across his belly. The boy beside Frank swayed on his feet like he might pass out. A murmur ran through the mass of people when they began to realize what had just occurred. Bog dropped his pistol and fell to his knees. He stared at the smoking horse pistol in Morgan's left hand.
Thought I had it figured.
Frank had worried about the big 44 ball passing all the way through the grumpy outlaw, and aimed low, hoping the big bones in his hip would slow it down. No one behind the Swede fell over, so it must have worked. When he was certain Swenson was no longer a threat, Morgan turned and handed the rattling walker back to the wide-eyed boy he'd borrowed it from.
Much obliged for the loan of the pistol, son. I'd reload it quickly if I were you. I'm about to do the same with my own.
No, sir. I don't reckon I'll load it. I believe I'll just take it home and put it back in my pa's closet where I found it.
That's a good plan, son. But I have to say, I'm mighty glad you were around when you were.
Morgan fished a $20 gold piece out of his pocket and gave it to the boy.
I reckon my life was worth almost that much.
Lofton clapped his fat hands together and rubbed them in front of him like a housefly once his assistants dragged Bog Swenson's body away from the crowd.
Well, now, you need a few minutes to calm your nerves?
Morgan raised an eyebrow and gave the line judge a hard look.
Do I look nervous?
All right, then.
Lofton eyed Morgan and the dandy.
You two pistoleros are about to test your skill and provide some entertainment for the crowd at the same time.
He turned for the first time and addressed the gathered crowd.
Both of these men have proven they're better than average shooters. Now, let's see what they're really made of.
The line judge gave a nod to two men on the sidelines, and they carried two draped boxes downrange 15 paces. The boxes were flat, no more than a foot high, and 2 feet long.
That's not far enough to be much of an effort. I don't reckon either of us would have much trouble hitting a wooden box.
Inside those enclosures are 12 bobwhite quail, 6 for each of you. We'll jerk the top off, and you plug as many of the little beggars as you can before they fly out of range. My helpers in the tower will act as spotters for each of you. The winner of the fine colt Bisley is the one who gets the most quail. But I'm giving you both fair warning. You gotta get at least one, or nobody gets the prize.
At least one? You think he'd never seen you shoot?
Frank just nodded and studied the box downrange.
Care to put a little added wager on this round?
I don't believe I do.
Suit yourself. Just trying to earn a little extra gambling money.
Lofton's men moved off to the left and picked up a long cord that was attached to the lids of both quail boxes so they'd both come off at the same time.
Mind the crowd and careful where you're shooting, boys. You ready?
Each man focused his attention on the box in front of him. Each gave a slow, deliberate nod. On Lofton's command, the two assistants tugged on the cord and the flat lids slid off the two boxes. Frank watched a half a dozen quail explode out of the box on his side with a drumming flurry of beating wings. His peacemaker was out of the holster before the last bird cleared the box. He cut down two as they flew up and away from the cheering crowd. Another hapless bird tried to zip straight up in the air. Morgan sent him tumbling back into the box he came out of. One of the quail locked its wings and glided toward Lofton. Frank pulled up to keep from winging more than the bird. By the time he was able to get back on target, the other two birds were safely out of range. Frank shrugged and returned his Colt to the holster. He'd been concentrating so intently on his own targets, he had no idea how his competition had done.
I'll let three get away.
Morgan watched the remaining birds lock their wings and glide away until they were nothing more than dark specks on the prairie.
Three birds on the wing with a pistol? That's some fancy shooting.
I still let three slip away.
So did he. And you put one back in the box.
You are a remarkable shootist, Mr. Morgan. But from the looks of things, we may have to cut the prize in half. The great drifter may have finally met his match. It seems I may be equally as good.
You may be at that.
Lofton sauntered up the line in front of Frank. He had the quail boxes stacked in his hands, resting against the belly of his overalls over his gun belt. He didn't look happy to give up his prize pistol, but he was clearly impressed with the shooting display.
I gotta say, I'm surprised, but it appears we got us a winner, folks.
What do you mean a winner? We both got three birds. I'd call that flat even.
That you did, son.
He reached into Ferguson's box and scooped out three tattered bob whites and tossed them at the young dandy's feet. The huge .45 caliber balls of lead had reduced the bodies to ragged bits of bloody skin and brown feathers. He moved back over to Frank and counted the birds out of his box in front of him.
You both got three birds, but this feller left his edible.
Each of Frank's quail lay at his feet intact, the heads neatly clipped from the bodies. Ferguson strode over, crushing his hat in his hands while he studied the quail. The dandy stood and replaced his hat, staring daggers at Morgan and the line judge.
This is an insult. You never said a word about this in the rules. It's a draw, damn you.
His hand tapped the handle of his pistol. Frank raised an eyebrow and got ready. He'd hoped it wouldn't come to this.
Boy, you listen to me. It's obvious who the better shooter is, and I told you from the get-go all my decisions are final. Now you listen here, youngster. You've done good. Better than almost every man here. Be happy about that. If you push this, you're liable to end up all shot up like those birds of yours. You got it?
Morgan shot a glance at the shotgun-wielding men in the tower. Each had his weapon trained at Ferguson. It didn't seem to occur to them that at that range, the blasts would kill or maim half a dozen bystanders as well. Frank studied the sneering men more closely and decided they just didn't care.
This isn't the end of it. Not by a long shot, it's not.
A moment later, he pushed his way into the crowd without a backward glance.
I didn't figure him for a fool. They always gotta say something tough like that, don't they?
I reckon they generally do. But I think this one means it.
Whew, that Ferguson boy was giving you some mighty strong stink eye before he disappeared. I'd watch him if I were you. How'd you do that, Frank?
I aim for the eyes. It's the same as flock shooting for ducks. If you aim at all of them, you're more than likely to hit nothing but air. When you go to face a man, put that front sight on a button or a pocket watch, not the whole caboodle. You won't miss by much. I aimed at the eye and got lucky and hit the head. Ferguson just aimed at the bird.
You are feeling better.
As a matter of fact, I feel fit as a fiddle. But I'm smart enough to know I've only got so many years left in me. A bandit can only cheat the gallows so many times. So it goes with a gunman and a bullet.
Morgan, I do believe you're getting poetic in your old age.
I reckon dying twice will do that to a man. Take a look at this.
To Frank Morgan, Amarillo, Texas. From Mercy Monfer, Weatherford, Texas. Dear Frankie, stop. Need your help. Stop. Know you've been sick, but please come home as soon as you are able. Stop. Fear my family is in jeopardy. Stop. Watch yourself. Stop. Things all mixed up here. Stop. Want you to meet my daughter. Stop. She has your temper. And who is this Mercy Monfer?
A girl. A woman I knew years ago.
What do you aim to do?
I'm going to Parker County and check this out. If you're coming, you best get a saddle on that mean little beast you call a horse.
2 days after they crossed the Red River, Beaumont noticed a loose shoe on his bay's hind foot. It was late afternoon, and a gentle breeze rustled the dark leaves on the thick stands of post oak along the old wagon road. The air had warmed considerably after they left the open country around Amarillo, and tiny bugs floated in thick swarms along the road. Tiny brown tweet birds flitted and chattered in the thick tangles of briars and new spring underbrush. Morgan stood in the stirrups and stretched, scanning the rolling hills around him. The miles had been hard on his old bones, but he could feel the life coming back to his muscles. A half a mile ahead, a cloud of several hundred red-winged blackbirds rose in unison like a dark wave from the green canopy of trees, only to settle back a few seconds later. Their chirps and fluttering wings carried on the light wind. Morgan studied the spot. Someone else was on the road ahead of them. He couldn't tell if they were coming or going, but something, or more likely someone, had disturbed the flock of birds. He glanced around for Wolf, but the cur was nowhere to be found, probably hot on the trail of some rabbit or green-tailed lizard. That was the trouble with Wolf. He was fiercely loyal when he happened to be around, but he led his own life and went where his old nose took him. Morgan couldn't fault him for that. It was a quality they both shared.
I'm still thinking a nice bed and a good hotel would be the way to go. I never did cut much to sleeping on the ground.
Beaumont cleaned the hoof, replaced the loose shoe, and tapped the nails in one by one, ringing the sharp ends off as he went with the claw of his hammer.
I know what you mean, but I'd prefer to steer clear of towns for a few days while I get my legs back under me. I'd like to ease into things.
Beaumont set the clinches on all 8 nails and set the foot back down, rolling his shoulders to relax them from the recent effort.
You're pretty good at that. Ever think of taking up the profession? Not near as dangerous as this lawman stuff.
Oh, you think horseshoeing is safe?
He pulled back his shirt collar to show a jagged white scar shaped like a 6-inch smile just below his neck.
My granddaddy told me horseshoeing was good business for a short man like me.
Beaumont walked around the bay and picked up each foot in turn, checking the shoes while he had his tools out.
So I took him at his word. I was shoeing a big sorrel mare that belonged to an old widow woman outside of Kerrville. The widow woman wasn't the nicest person I ever come across, and the mare took all her personality from the old bag. Damn horse picked me up with her teeth and threw me across the barn. Nearly took my head off. I told that widow woman right there I would have to shoot the horse between the eyes to get her shod. But then I told her I could guarantee the shoes would stay on for 8 weeks.
I see your point.
Beaumont stuffed the hammer and clinch block back in his saddlebag.
No, sir, Frank. I don't mind telling you. I'd as soon be in a running gun battle with a dozen Mexican bandits as shoe someone else's horse anymore. It just ain't worth...
Just an observation. Didn't know I'd stir up a hornet's nest on the subject.
Frank dismounted and dug around in his saddlebags for a small pot. They'd foregone the use of a pack horse, wanting to make better time, so he didn't have room for a proper coffee pot. Instead, he'd settled for a small pan that held no more than 3 cups of water. Morgan held up the little pot.
What do you say we have us a cup or two? I find that a good cup of coffee will generally chase most unpleasantness out of my head, even thoughts about horseshoeing.
Beaumont gathered some small oak branches for a fire while Morgan got the water ready to boil. The fire was just beginning to burn well when 4 horsemen came ambling up the road toward them at a slow walk. Both men stood to watch as the newcomers approached.
If it ain't the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse.
Apocalypse, maybe. But I'll show them hell if they interrupt my coffee with anything shady.
The 4 men approached tentatively, scanning the road ahead of them, turning often to check their back trail. All carried their hands loosely at their sides, but each had a pistol at his hip and a rifle or shotgun in the scabbard at his side. The leader had a short-barreled coach gun in a wallet holster across the pommel of his saddle. It was canted at such an angle that if it happened to go off at the wrong moment, it might hit his own mount in the neck. The men were obviously saddle tramps. Their ragged clothes were cobbled together from whatever they could beg or steal. The leader, or at least the man who rode point, straddled a flea-bitten gray bag of bones that looked as though it hadn't seen an oat or speck of corn in months. Ribs stuck out like slats on a feed bunk, and the poor animal's hip bones jutted out to show oozing sores. A swarm of flies buzzed around the horse's rheumy eyes and bent Roman nose. The lead rider wore a gray homespun jacket with a huge tear along the left side where a pocket used to be, a wilted hat with a matching rip in the brim covered a nest of matted brown locks. In fact, every inch of clothing the man wore was torn or damaged in some fashion or another. Morgan decided to call this one Rip, no matter what his name was. The way he and the others were eyeing Stormy and the bay, there was bound to be some trouble.
Evening, gents.
Rip tipped his torn hat and crossed his hands across the saddle horn. The leather wrap around the horn had come loose and hung like a lazy snake in a loose coil between the shotgun wallet and the scuffed pommel.
You fixing to make some coffee?
We were at that. My pot's a little on the small side, I'm afraid. So you boys will have to wet your whistles elsewhere. We only got enough for 2.
Well, that's my unneighborly of you, mister.
Just stating a fact. Never been much of one to tiptoe around the point. I'd be much obliged if you just state your business straight out. That way, me and my friend here don't have to go guessing at it.
Morgan's hand hovered above his Colt. He didn't have to look to know Beaumont had adopted the same posture. Rip grinned, showing a mouth half full of yellow teeth, and threw a glance over his shoulder at his compatriots.
This beats it all, don't it, boys? We ain't gonna be able to pull one over on these two, that's for sure.
One of the others, who was just as filthy and tattered, but looked as though he wasn't a day over 14, rolled one eye and giggled like a maniac until Rip gave him a withering stare.
Shut the hell up, Boudreaux. You guessed right, partner. We want your clothes and your horses. As you can see, ours are plumb worn out.
The three outlaws behind him suddenly fanned out to make themselves more difficult targets.
Now, both of you, take it easy with those shooters of yours. Get them hands up high. There's six of us and two of you. Now that ain't very good odds.
Six? My eyes must be going.
Beaumont slowly raised his hands, even with his ears. Rip's lips pulled back in a victorious smirk, and he shook his head back and forth.
Of course you don't see six, you stupid bastard. That's because two of my men are hiding in the bushes yonder with rifles pointed at your brain buckets right this very minute.
That a fact?
Damn right it's a fact. Now, both of you, just step out of them clothes. I fancy that nice blue shirt you've got on there, boy.
Rip nodded at the Cinco Peso Ranger badge.
Now, that little trinket might come in handy down the road. Them short-legged breeches of yours will likely fit Boudreaux. Now, hurry up and shuck them off.
Yeah! Hurry up and shuck off them breeches!
I told you to shut your mouth, Booty. Can't you see I'm working here?
Neither Morgan or Beaumont moved a muscle.
Now, you boys got mud in your ears or something? I said shuck off them clothes.
Don't believe I will. I want to give you fair warning, mister. Any of you make a move for your guns, and I'll cut you down where you sit.
Now, see here, I told you. I got men in the trees there keeping an eye on you. Now, if you want to live, you best do what I say.
Wolf came bounding out of the bushes with a long black snake in his jaws. He trotted over to Morgan and dropped the dead prize at his feet, growling low in his throat at the mounted men. A smile spread across Morgan's face, and he let his hands fall slowly toward his side. Beaumont slowly lowered his hands as well.
Keep your hands where I can see them, boys.
You think Wolf would have noticed if there were men hiding in the bushes, Morgan?
Not much gets by Wolf. It was a decent plan. He just picked the wrong men to try it on.
So what if it was just us? There's four of us against only two of you.
What do you think, Frank? I'm not of a mind to give up my clothes.
Me either.
You smart-mouthed bastards. I ain't leaving here without them clothes.
Rip dropped for his gun, and the others behind him followed suit. Oh! Ah! Morgan's first shot sent Rip tumbling back out of the saddle into Booty. Oh! Oh! Who accidentally shot him again in the thigh. Beaumont silenced the maniacal kid and one of the others while Morgan finished off the last one, easily beating the outlaw to the draw. Rip lay bleeding on the ground, blinking up against the low sun.
What'd you have to go and do that for?
You called the shots, mister, not me.
Well, what do you think, Morgan? I reckon we'll have to bury him now. That's gonna set us back considerable.
Morgan, you say? Are you Frank Morgan?
I am.
Damn my luck. My first job out of prison, and I gotta pick Frank Morgan to rob. I never had no damn luck at all.